My daughter Hannah returned home from her first year of college this past week. And I am somewhat sad to say that she's a little ticked at the church. Not this church, of course, but the church in general. And before I go on, it's also worth noting that she's reported to me that she's probably going to become a religion major. Some irony and justice in that, I suppose. Any event, this all stems from the fact that this past semester she took an introductory course in the Bible. And in taking this course, she learned, apparently for the first time, that there were other creation accounts that were circulating around before this creation account was circulating around, and that they have some similarities. And she learned, apparently for the first time, that there were other flood stories that had been circulating around before this flood story of Noah had begun circulating. She tells me that several of her classmates, when they were confronted with this information, apparently also for the first time in this introduction to the Bible class, became defensive and even a little testy at the professor. They wanted to deny that these other creation accounts could have actually predated the creation account that we have here. And they wanted to deny the implication, which was that perhaps the Hebrew people borrowed from some of the other creation accounts when they reflected on how God acted in creating the universe that we have. Hannah, on the other hand, was more frustrated with the church than with her professor. She asked me, why didn't I learn about this from any pastor standing up in the pulpit? And she said, why didn't I learn about this in Sunday school? Why didn't I learn about this in youth group when I had Bible studies? And I thought in my own mind, I never learned about it until I went to college either. Isn't it interesting that all through church life, we're not told about these things? And then we find out about them through some other means. And the questions start to come up for inquisitive teenage minds. Is the church hiding something? Now, I've got my ideas as to why pastors don't talk about other creation accounts or other flood stories very often. And one of them is time. When you've got 20 minutes or so to do a sermon, you can't spend a lot of time talking about these other accounts that really don't have any authority behind them. Another one may be that pastors themselves are a little uncomfortable with the fact that there's these other creation accounts out there. A third one may be that pastors are concerned that they will receive the same treatment as Hannah's college professor, that congregations may take offense at the messenger for delivering a certain message. And I suppose time will tell whether that third concern bears itself out. So as we work through this creation story and to help look at it from a fresh perspective, I'd like to pay a little bit of honor to Hannah's complaint, to her concern. And I'd like to actually look at our creation story that we have and put it alongside a popular creation myth that existed around the Hebrew people. And I think it only does honor for the Bible and for the Hebrew people because these creation myths surrounded them. And when they read the story in Torah as to how God created this universe, they had to have been reading it with the mind of these other myths that were out there. Besides, I think if we look at it and we compare it, we can see perhaps what the Hebrew people were trying to get at as they were enlightening us regarding God's work in the world. Bernard Anderson, a scholar, said, put it this way, the Hebrew Bible contains no myth which traces the creation to a primordial battle between divine powers, no ritual which enables men to repeat the mythological drama and thereby ensure the supremacy of their national god. Mythological allusions have been torn out of their ancient context of polytheism and nature religion and have acquired completely new meanings within Israel's faith. The pagan language may survive, but only as the poetic speech for the adoration of the Lord of history. I think once you compare the Babylonian creation story with our creation story, it becomes pretty clear, and I hope I'll be able to show it to you, that we worship a God that's radically different than the God that was told about in the myths of the time. So here in a Reader's Digest condensed version is the Babylonian creation story. Let's see if you can track some themes. Before the world existed, there was a giant mass of salt water named Apsu. He was a male god. And there was this giant mass of fresh water named Tiamut, and she was a goddess. And Apsu and Tiamut combined together, and through their combining together, out sprang from the waters a second generation of gods. And those gods mated, and out from them sprang a third generation and a fourth generation. We'll call them young gods. And as often happens in a house that has lots of young people in it, sometimes young gods, Apsu became upset with all the noise and all the bluster and all the boisterousness, and he made a plan to kill all the young gods. Apsu's plan was discovered, and Apsu himself was killed. Tiamut, Apsu's wife, then said, "I'll avenge my husband, and I will kill all the young gods." So Tiamut set out to kill the young gods, and from these young gods, one god emerged named Marduk. And Marduk and Tiamut entered into this cosmic battle. And Marduk caused Tiamut to inflate like a huge balloon. And then Marduk took his bow and his arrow and he shot it into Tiamut's belly. And she split open like a clamshell. That's their wording, clamshell. Then Marduk took this torso, this body, and he put it like a tent over the earth. And that tent separated the waters above from the waters on the earth. And then he took other gods and he placed them up in the sky as stars. And he took another god and he placed it up in the sky as the moon. And then he instructed the stars and the moon to go in their courses to set seasons and days. Then Marduk did a favor for the other young gods. The young gods had to do all the drudge work for the other gods and the families. So Marduk took the blood of a god that he had killed, and he created, as they say, savage man. And savage man was created for the sole purpose of serving these young gods so that they would no longer have to do the drudgery, the day-to-day drudgery that young gods often have to do. That's the Babylonian creation story. As you can see, both of the stories have certain similarities. The sequence of creation, for example, is roughly the same, a little simplified perhaps, but you have the heavens and the earth are created, and then they're separated, and then the stars are placed, the moon is placed, and then they're given their courses, and at the very end, humans are created. But it's the differences between these two stories that really stand out. For instance, in the Babylonian story, the account of creation arises from bloodshed, from hatred, from war. Tiamut is split open, and her carcass is put up as a shell over the earth. Now look at the creation story that we have in Genesis. Creation comes from the loving work of a loving and powerful God. Love, blessedness, it is good, it is good, it is good, refrains throughout this whole story. Another difference is that the Hebrews rejected the notion that creation was haphazard. In this account, the account that we have, creation is very orderly. God creates certain things, and then God populates those things. He creates the heavens, and he populates the heaven with the stars and the moon and the sun. He creates the earth, and he populates the earth. And he creates humans. But there are two differences in these two stories that really stand out in my mind and I think speak to us in terms of how we might live our lives. First is that in the Hebrew story of creation, God speaks the world into being. God speaks and there's light. God speaks and the light and the dark are separated. God speaks and there's a barrier between the waters above and the waters below. God speaks and the world is formed. God speaks and the world is populated. When we speak, it's not just sound that comes out of us. It's also breath that comes out of us. It comes up from our diaphragm, through our lungs, out of the mouth, and it's our breath that carries our sound. In the Hebrew, interestingly enough, the word for breath and the word for spirit are one and the same words, ruach. This translation says that the ruach of God hovered over the chaos before creation. The breath of God hovered over creation. The spirit of God hovered over creation. It's God's ruach, God's breath, and God's living spirit that flows into everything that has life. Everything that we see around us that's teeming with life has God's spirit imbued in it, God's breath. The psalmist says, "By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all their host by the breath of his mouth." In the story of Pentecost, you see this relationship between spirit and breath and word. For on the day of Pentecost, the Spirit comes down, it breathes into the apostles. And what do the apostles do in response? They go out and they proclaim by voice, by their breath, their ruach. They proclaim the good news of Christ's life and death and resurrection. So for the Hebrew people, the world that surrounded them was not a world of destruction and hatred and warfare and the survival of the fittest. It was a world that was blessed by God. It was a world that was imbued with God's spirit and God's breath. But there's another difference, and that's the way in which man, humanity, was created. In the Babylonian myth, humans were created merely as servants, garbage haulers, you might say, for these young gods. But in our creation account, we find that humans were created for an entirely different purpose. In our creation account, God called us to be servants, stewards of his creation. We're the pinnacle of the created order. Everything else, it was good. But after the creation of humans, the created order was very good, exceedingly good in some translations. On top of that, we were created with the order that we were to help tend to this earth, this creation. We were created as partners with God, as agents of God. And I wonder if perhaps it's that role that we have in partnering with God to sustain the creation. I wonder if it's that role that caused God to make us in his image. We're made in his image because we're called in a fashion to be his agents in this world. We are fashioned after God so that we're equipped to do the work of God in the world around us. When we understand that all of creation is imbued with God's life-giving spirit, and we understand that our role in creation is to help sustain that life, life looks a lot different for the Hebrew people. It looks a lot different for us as Christians. We become God's special agents of love and life in God's creation, which is loving and lively. As the bearers of God's image, perhaps one way that we can help sustain the life of not just the created world, the mountains and the trees and the animals, but the created world, which are our neighbors, one way we can sustain their life is through our spoken word, through our breath, through God's ruach, God's spirit working through us. Do we use our words when we come into contact with others as an agent to give life? Or do we often use our words as an agent for destruction? One of my friends talked about going to an Easter egg hunt a few years ago, and this mother was dragging her little grade school age kid along to the Easter egg hunt and had her daughter stand up there when the hunt got ready. And when the hunt started, she was off talking to some friends, cup of coffee in her hand. Little girl comes back a few minutes later, she found an Easter egg, and she shows it to her mom, and she's beaming with pride. And the mom's words were, "Is that all you could find? Is that the best you could do?" He says, "Let's get out of here," she says. And she drags her kid home. Not what you call a steward of God's creation. Not using the words, not using the ruach, the breath, the spirit that's within her to bring life. This past week, I was in Indianapolis along with Jana and Jessica. We were there for the Lilly Transition into Ministry program. All of the Lilly residents from all around the country gathered. And my roommate was in a slightly different program, also funded by Lilly. He'd been a pastor for 10 or 12 years. And every morning we went downstairs for breakfast. It was on the Lilly Foundation tab, so that was nice. So we had breakfast down at the hotel restaurant. And the first week that we were there, or the first day that we were there, this waitress, Dorothy, older woman, is waiting on us. And she's rushed and she's kind of harried. She's going from place to place. And it's a busy because there's a lot of other conferences there. And then the second day, Dorothy wasn't there. And the third day, our last day there, Dorothy reappeared. She's our waitress again. And Eric, my roommate, said to her, "Dorothy, you weren't here yesterday." And she says, "No, I was busy across the hall. We had a banquet over there. I had to do that." And he says, "I missed you." And she kind of pauses for a second. And he says to her, "You're a good waitress. It's nice to have you back. How long have you been working here, Dorothy?" And you can see her shoulders kind of settle down a little bit. And she gets a little bit of a smile on her face. And she tells us she's been working there for 18 years. And she's ready to retire in a year or two. And looking forward to time with her kids and her grandkids and all of that. And he says, "Dorothy, it was nice talking with you." And I know there's a smile on her face, and it might have been my imagination, but I could have sworn that she stepped a little lighter than she had when she came over. And as I sat there, I wondered to myself, did Eric at that moment act as God's steward to breathe ruach, to breathe life, to breathe breath, to breathe God's spirit into this woman? Did Eric act as an agent of God, if only for a moment, and if only for one particular place, did he act as an agent of God to sustain life and to give honor to God's creation? Of course, taking the time to breathe life into people also means two things. We have to take the time, and we have to actually see people. Maybe that means that instead of going to the gas station and taking out the credit card and putting it in the slot in the gas pump, maybe it means actually going inside and speaking to, breathing upon, if you will, the person behind the counter. Maybe it means instead of going through the drive-thru at Starbucks or McDonald's or Burger King, to actually walk inside and spend a few minutes talking to the person behind the counter or maybe even a few seconds. Maybe it means that instead of what I see quite often, people go up to a counter and they say to the person, "I'll take a number four with a Diet Coke." Maybe it means actually saying something really outrageous like, "Hi," or "How are you today?" Maybe it means taking a risk to actually breathe, to speak to them, to try to convey some of God's spirit and God's life onto the people that we come in contact with. Unlike the creation myths, we are created in God's image. Unlike the creation myths, we are created with a divine, holy purpose. As God's agents, you and I share a unique ability to offer life through our words. Take a dare. Risk finding the words to possibly speak your neighbor into new life. While the Babylonians may not have believed it was possible, you and I know it's exactly what we were made for. Amen.